Chapter 16. But I did. It was a jolt, like being woken up in the middle of a dream. I looked around and took in surroundings that I knew instantly and viscerally to be the true manifestation of reality. Metal walls cased me in. They stretched away in four directions, leading along the forward and lateral axes of the ship. The walls were a messy mosaic of handholds, service grills, instruments, consoles, viewports, monitoring cameras, and cased-in equipment modules. Strip lights gridded the walls, putting out a low red radiance just enough to navigate and work by. Data entry terminals glowed with faint blue luminescence, computer keys backlit by softly glowing LEDs. Any surface that was not already doing something was covered in Velcro patches and nylon tethers. Adhesive notes fluttered in the currents of the air recirculators, one or two of them broken free to wander the ship like pale yellow paper butterflies. Stenciled instructions, directions, and warning messages covered every other item. I recognized the lettering. It was the same Spartan typeface I had glimpsed on the engine room of the paddle steamer. Then, as now, reality had broken through the dream. I crouched on one of the access grills, resting on my haunches. My outfit was yellow, a tight-fitting suit of the kind designed to resist movement and therefore counteract the wastage of bone, muscle, and cardiovascular systems across extended periods of weightlessness. I pinched at the fabric around my shoulder where an emblem had been embossed. It said Demeter ESSE in big letters, with a stylized image beneath it. Jupiter in the background, the off-white sphere of Europa in the foreground, and an arrow looping in from deep space, indicating the trajectory of our mission. The arrow formed a bow around Europa, and the sharp end of it jagged down to the ice and into the moon's interior. Familiar names around the ring of the mission emblem. Von Voot, Murgatroyd, Topolsky, and so on, as well as the logos of our major commercial sponsors. ESSE, I mouthed aloud, then remembering, Europa Subsurface Explorer. That's us. That's the expedition. We had come across interplanetary space, riding an experimental fusion rocket for the speediest possible crossing. Quick as that had been compared to chemical or ion propulsion modes, the crew had still needed to be placed into an equally experimental form of suspended animation. The purpose of that was both to conserve valuable onboard resources and also to keep everyone from going mad in the psychological pressure cooker of the spacecraft. After the initial cruise boost, Demeter had been weightless until Jupiter interface, where its engines had been relit to slow down again and guide Demeter into orbit around Europa. We were not weightless now, though. The ship splits, I said aloud, lost in a rapture of remembrance. Part stays in orbit, part goes down. The surface module drills down through the ice, then slips into the ocean underneath, becoming a submersible spacecraft. Our airlocks become hydrolocks. When we've completed our investigations, we return to orbit to rendezvous with the cruise module, ready for the long haul back to Earth. My weight alone told me that we had reached Europa. Although there was a definite sense of up and down, I hardly needed any energy to maintain my crouching posture. Beyond the viewport studded around me was blackness that extended in all directions. In space, that was rarely the case. One aspect of the ship would normally be exposed to sunlight, albeit attenuated by distance, and the other would be in shade. Indeed, it was standard procedure to rotate the ship so as to even out the thermal gradient across her components. It would only be totally dark if we were sliding through the shadow cast by a planet or moon, and even then there ought to be a few stars visible, their brightness heightened by the absence of competition from the sun. So I knew where we were, even without consulting the instruments and flight logs. Demeter had done the job it was constructed to do, reached the ocean of Europa. If I punctured one of those windows, it wouldn't be decompression I had to contend with. It would be the inrush of a billions-year-old briny ocean that had never known the sun's touch. An ocean that was only warmed and kept liquid by the tidal stresses of Europa's orbit around Jupiter. I reached out to touch the alloy of one of the adjoining panels. It felt real. Through it, I detected the hum of multiple life support processes, the churn of air circulators, generators, and heat exchangers. I studied my hand, where a scrawny wrist emerged from the tight cuff of the resistance suit. Slender fingers. A surgeon's hand. Did that touch of flesh on metal feel more real, more authentic than it had in the earlier versions of Demeter? Perhaps. The difference was that I now had the foreknowledge to interrogate my reality. Very rarely in dreams did we ever ask, "Is this a dream?" When we did, that question was often enough to collapse the dream's spell. This dream held. Which meant that it was not a dream, or that it was at least constructed on much firmer foundations than before. "This is real," I said, as if the act of assertion would in itself be sufficient to chemically fix myself in this version of Demeter. I could see now that the earlier versions of the ship had been distorted figments, metaphoric shadows, imperfect reflections of the truth. There was always the fissure, always the edifice, always the earlier expedition. Only now was I perceiving their unfiltered nature. The ship felt empty too. No voices or human noises reached my senses. A ghost ship in one respect, her crew reduced to phantoms. Everyone's already gone inside. So what am I still doing here? I returned my attention to the mission patch, to the cycle of names bordering it. And I saw there were seven. Chapter 17. I blinked aside a moment of dislocation, as if my train of thought had jumped from one set of rails to another. Giddiness washed over me. I steadied myself against one of the buckled panels of the gondola.
"You all right, Cody?" asked Miss Cassil. "You look as if someone just walked over your grave."
I remembered, but I shook my head, unable to organize my thoughts into anything that made sense to me, let alone that might to my companions.
"Perhaps Dupin's fever is contagious after all," Ramos said, with concern in his eyes.
"It's not that, Coronel. He had a glimpse of something, a truth he'd rather not face. It's so upsetting that he's reverted back into this narrative, forgetting the process of self-examination which led up to his moment of conceptual breakthrough."
Ramos regarded her with the wariness one accorded a feral cat.
"You do not sound yourself, Miss Cossil."
"Oh, did I slip out of character?"
She smiled at him pityingly.
"Who can blame a girl, eh? It's confusing enough for me, and I know what's happening to him."
His tone hardened.
"What is happening to him?"
"And you, you big Mexican galoot!"
She gave him a playful elbow.
"One moment you're bobbing along in his narrative like a toy boat, questioning nothing. The next, he's up to your perceptual threshold just enough for the truth to start bleeding through. But as soon as he starts grasping the big picture, the real picture, he shuts you down as well. You're conscious right now, but in an auto-suggestive state, swallowing his narrative cues wholesale. Eventually, that'll break down. He'll start remembering things again, like that trephination procedure. But only if he lets you live long enough, this time round."
"Why are you saying these things?" I asked.
"Because I'm an eternal optimist, and sooner or later some of this is going to have to stick. If it doesn't..."
"Colonel Ramos," called Murgatroyd, interrupting our exchange. "We found something. You'd all better see it." Ramos, Cassil, and I moved gingerly through the gondola, each of us eyeing the other. Some difficult, unfinished business was lying between us, as if we were obliged to resume an argument none of us could remember starting. Murgatroyd was standing by a rent in the gondola's side, where the outer plating had peeled away from a structural rib, leaving an opening about large enough to squeeze through. It was on the opposite side of the gondola to our point of entry, facing the edifice rather than Demeter. Beyond was darkness. I stared into that lightless immensity, and for a head-throbbing instant I perceived it as liquid. A black sea pressing against the little bubble of life and air in which we found ourselves. An immediate and terrible horror of drowning and confinement took hold of me, until I forced myself to once more see that blackness as an absence. Murgatroyd shone a lamp into the void. A gap of about 15 feet separated us from the edifice, or rather the tiny part of it nearest to us. The gondola had come to rest adjoining one of the smoother parts of the object, rather than one of the bristling areas. Against us, directly opposite the opening in the gondola, gaped a mouth. It was an orifice in the metal flesh, puckering outwards like a starlet's kiss. From the throat of that mouth vomited a mass of metal fronds, grasping out across the gap. A number of them had made contact with Europa, the fronds braided into the form of a loose openwork bridge, a tongue of ragged embroidery, as wide as a man and as tall. Bravely, Murgatroyd leaned out and shone the lamp up and around the outside of the gondola, while Mortlock grabbed onto his belt. "There's stock all over," he reported, before offering a boot to one of these tendrils. The frond shattered at the point of impact, dry flakes crumbling into the gulf beneath us. "We didn't see 'em from the other side, but they've grabbed onto this bit pretty well." A powerful revulsion overcame me, and I doubted I was alone in my feelings. The edifice had been inscrutable until now, its purpose as baffling as a sphinx. Now we understood that it had entertained designs on Europa, as a venomous plant may entertain designs on any insect hapless enough to stray into its sticky, paralyzing domain.
"It caught him," Mortlock summarized. "No wonder the poor beggars couldn't get back up and out."
"In the absence of facts, we ought not allow our speculations to run amok," said Brooker. "Will this do for your facts?" I asked, hefting a journal that lay open on a shelf by the rent. "The last entry is quite succinct, Herr Brooker. Shall I read it for you?" Brooker snatched the book from me. "I am quite capable of reading for myself, Dr. Code." But his voice faltered as he began to narrate the final entry that I had already seen for myself. "I got out. It's coming back. Coming to drag me back in. Back to the others. Leave while you can."
There was never any doubt but that we would go in after the vanished crew of Europa. If any of our party had private doubts as to the wisdom of this action, especially in light of the warning, not one of us had the courage to express them.
"A brief foray only," Brooker said. "We go a little way into the monstrosity, but only as far as our portable telephone line allows, yeah? I think it is possible to reel out some more line, Mr. Murgatroyd."
"About another 200 feet, but if it's all right with you, Herr Brooker, we'll let Captain von Voelt know what we plan first."
Brooker signalled his agreement with a peremptory waggle of his fingers.
"By all means."
Murgatroyd took the handset and wound the little brass handle which supplied power for the conversation.
"Captain," he inquired, "we've gone through what's left of their airship. They've all gone, taking their pressure gear with them. Into the edifice, Captain, that's what it looks like. No, Captain. Yes, a sort of door.
Equipment, yes.
No, we don't need to come back just yet. The air is no worse here than it is back at your end. What does Colonel Ramos say? Let me have a word with him."
Brooker snatched the handset from Murgatroyd.
"The situation is quite clear, Captain von Voelt. There is no need for extra consideration. If he finds that we are challenged by the conditions, we shall return for Demeter's respirators, but not before then. Do you agree with this haste? I asked Ramos, as Murgatroyd concluded his conversation, lowering the handset back into the cradle.
I never agree with haste, Silas. But if I were in there and in trouble, I would not want men to delay finding me.
Whatever became of them, I said, whatever that message is meant to make us think, those men will be long dead by now.
Then their bones will welcome us,
Ramos said, as if that was supposed to settle all my concerns. Then, with an encouraging pat,
come, Silas. Even dead men deserve a doctor.
Now that we were committed to our venture, I had no desire but to have it all over and done with. But first, our means of crossing between the gondola and the edifice had to be made safe, and that took 20 minutes of careful deliberation between Murgatroyd and Ramos. The first business was to hack away a sufficient quantity of fronds to enable a man to crawl unobstructed from one side to the other. At the moment, it was as impassable as the thickest part of a jungle. The men hacked with implements both blunt and sharp. There were axes and machetes on Europa, besides the tools we had brought over. Until about half the fronds had been shattered away, leaving only the sturdiest, thickest fronds, mostly concentrated near the effective floor of this curious bridge. These fronds produced a dead, hollow note when struck, but were much harder to damage. And in the end we accepted that our efforts were having little further effect. We had one ladder spare from our climb down into the gondola, so this was brought down and pushed out into the 15-foot gap, using the fronds as a supporting medium. Mortlock got onto hands and knees and gamely crawled out far enough to tie the ladder down, one knot at a time. Some further ropes were strung along at waist height to serve as makeshift handholds, but I do not think any one of us would choose to trust our lives to them, attached as they were to only the brittle stumps of fronds we'd already severed. Ramos, who was by far the heaviest member of the party, went out first and got safely to the other side. He hacked away with his machete, clearing the obstruction of fronds within the moor at the other end. He hooked a booted foot into the edifice, looked around inside with a lamp, a murky greenish light playing across his features, then gestured for the rest of us to follow. Clearly, he judged that the immediate point of entry was safe enough for the party to proceed, but I saw nothing in the stoic set of his features to suggest enthusiasm or relief. One by one we joined him. Murgatroyd was the last, spooling out the extra length of telephone cable as he joined us. The inside of the edifice, that tiny part which had now admitted us, was deeply unsettling. Nothing in my commonplace experience gave me any satisfactory point of reference. The best I could attempt would be to evoke the inside of a gasworks, or perhaps a sewerage works, festooned with all manner of pipes and vessels, grown in complexity and purpose over many years, perhaps even many generations, such that no foreman could confidently say what any of the older pipes or vessels did, or which was vital and which was obsolete, only that, rather than tearing out that which was already there to make way for the new, it was better, safer, to keep adding and adding, with each additional pipe having to worm and wriggle its way around what was already established, and each new vessel or retort having to be squeezed into the narrowing gaps between those already present, so that their shapes grew progressively more distended and asymmetrical, as the newer organs of the body must fit around the older. That we were in a sort of machine was beyond dispute. But it was a machine that had grown over and around and through itself time and again until its innards were as intricate and tangled as any stomach. Would that the parts had achieved a perfect density of form, excluding any possible addition, as then our exploration would have been at an end. We could have progressed no further. But there were gaps all about the forms, and some of them were large enough to squeeze through, albeit with varying degrees of difficulty and disquiet. The forms were rigid to the touch, the organ-like vessels hard as boilers,
and the pipes, which were merely internal extensions of the fronds which had erupted through that mouth, were quite inert, even as they were hammered by machetes and axe heads. But here was the undeniable fact. At some point they had indeed moved, wriggling and braiding across that gap to Europa. And since the ship had been trapped there, it could not have been a slow process. The stomach through which we now squeezed and crawled might merely be between meals. There is more to say. Although there was no one part of the interior that testified to a torsional process, taken as a whole, to the limit of our lamps and eyes, there was the unavoidable impression that we were navigating through a space that had been altered, stretched, twisted, elongated and compressed, in a sort of slow but inexorable fashion, as the grinding processes of the Earth's crust may squeeze a mountain range until its strata fold over themselves like bedsheets. Above all else, and perhaps worst of all, there was that green light, a sort of misty, sickly-smelling effusion. My thoughts flashed back to poor Dupin, wondering what he would make of this mathematical puzzle made manifest. Imagining how these surroundings would have overwhelmed him, I was both glad of his absence and sorry that he was denied the excitement of intellectual stimulation. "Perhaps we should go back for the respirators after all," I said. Brooker snapped back to Murgatroyd. "How much line is left?" He replied, "About 80 feet." "Then we have already come more than halfway. There is no sense in going back now when no one is complaining. Do you not concur, Colonel?"
"We may go a little further," Ramos allowed.
We advanced, moving in a general sense to the left of our point of entry, but quickly passing beyond any dependable reference. Ramos had a compass, but it was no more reliable inside the edifice than it had been outside, and I think he glanced at its whirling needle more out of habit than any expectation of usefulness. We had the crude measurement of distance afforded by the telephone wire, and some sense that our arc was bending both down and away from the gondola. But it would have taken an elaborate series of surveying measurements to determine our position accurately. What I did know, what I felt most intimately in my bones, was that each difficult step, each squeezing increment of progress, was a progression too far. I will not deny my relief when Murgatroyd called out that the telephone line was at its limit. Now we could go back with our consciences clear. We had made a brave effort, travelled some considerable distance into this unworldly labyrinth of pipes and vessels, breathing its foul emanations, and now we must abort our quest. No dishonour lay in this abandonment. We had come much further than other men would have done.
"There is something ahead of us," Ramos said,
shining his lamp through a particularly narrow and forbidding gap.
"Something which we have not seen until now. It is only a little further, gentlemen."
"Of course," I said, nodding as eagerly as I could.
"Herr Brooker, do you concur?"
the Mexican asked.
Yeah, by all means, Colonel."
"Miss Cosil?"
"Show me to the story, boys."
One by one we followed Ramos into the space he had identified. It was indeed a space, a sudden, unexpected hollowing out of our previously cramped and oppressive surroundings. Here, the pipes and organs were folded tightly against curving walls, which reminded me of a pelvic girdle, if bone were metal. And in these walls, we found the objects of our investigation. 6 upright recesses had been carved into one wall, and 6 more on the opposing face. There were 5 people on one side, and 6 on the other, leaving only one of the recesses unoccupied. A glance was all it took to see they all wore garments perfectly familiar to us in form and function, familiar indeed to any well-sponsored expedition of the modern age. They had heavy coats and trousers of leather and sheepskin, worn in overlapping layers, accompanied by fur-lined boots and gloves. They had hoods over their heads, with goggles and high-altitude respirators masking their faces. Oxygen bottles hung from their belts, along with a plethora of tools and instruments. They were as still as statues. As still as corpses, for that matter. The party of five was nearest to us.
"We've got it wrong, then," Mortlock said. "There's 11 of them."
"There were only 6 respirator cases on Europa," I reminded him.
"Maybe the other boxes got tossed overboard or something."
"Even if that were the case, we agreed that 6 was about the right crew for an airship of that size. I can accept that we underestimated the crew by 1 or 2 men, perhaps as many as 3, if some of them were prepared to go without bunks, but that there were 11 of them?" Ramos purred.
"You are right, Silas. Some of these men came from another expedition."
Gingerly, he reached into the funnel formed by the fur-lined hood of the first explorer. "Be careful," I said. Ramos worked at the goggles that had fitted tightly above the respirator. As he did so, the goggles' leather strap crumbled in his fingers. The goggles came away whole in his glove, along with a fibrous mass of hair which must have been matted to the more fused by cold. Ramos made an involuntary inhalation. I moved to his side and saw why. I had expected a corpse. What I saw was worse. I have seen many corpses and many stages of human decay. I knew well the stations of that particular process. What I saw now was closer to mummification, or perhaps a singularly inept example of human taxidermy. The bones were there, and so was the skin. So too were the nerves, veins, arteries, muscles, and ligaments which normally lay beneath skin. But nothing else. No flesh beneath that skin, nothing to soften the angularity of bone. No ordinary process of mortal decomposition had produced this grinning, staring visage. The eyes were the worst part of it. They had shrunken into those sockets, but the eyelids were open, and there was still a hideous vigour in the eyeballs, as if they were made of coloured glass, retaining a parody of life while it deserted the rest of the body.
"This was not a good death," Ramos said.
"No," I agreed. "It was not. I think they were alive for a very long time while the life slowly leached out of them. Until there was nothing left to use. Until they were no further use to this thing." I drew his attention to the tangle of pipes festooned around each of the alcoves like a horrible bower of vines. Finer and finer those pipes divided and spread, until their narrowest creeping extremities went into the corpse, penetrating the layers of garments in search of such withered anatomy as remained beneath. Gingerly, I eased back the hood, feeling its stiff resistance. It was enough to see that the pipes formed a garland over the skull, tunneling into it at a dozen bloodless points of entry. "What does it want?" I asked, in a trance of revulsion.
"Information," said Miss Cassile. "But then you knew that."
"La Vigilia de Pietra," Ramos said, as if it were a prayer for his own salvation. "We have come too late for these poor souls."
"We'll examine them all," I said. "But first we should tell Captain von Voot what it is we've found here. That way he can begin making preparations for our departure."
"We are leaving?"
Ramos asked. "Of course. You said it yourself. We came too late." Chapter 18. We did not expect Murgatroyd to be long, but the brevity of his call was still a surprise. We soon understood why.
"Deloyne is dead," he said, offering an apologetic grimace. "It's snagged or broken somewhere between here and our ship. I've tugged on the line and it still feels stiff, so I don't think the damage is anywhere near us. I'm afraid we'll have to retreat until it can be repaired. It's too risky to be in here with no means of signalling." You are right, Henry, Ramos said.
Yeah, indeed, Brooker agreed. Of course, one regrets being torn away from the investigation, but these men have been here for a while, I said. They will still be here when we return, no better or worse than they are now. I think they will forgive us a tactical retreat. Slowly, methodically, we made our way back through the innards of the object, relieved that the line extended all the way back out to Europa, and that at no point had the parts of the machine closed in or otherwise moved to deny us passage. We would return, I vowed to myself, even if it was with fuel bottles and a packet of matches. The abomination in that chamber had to be cleansed one way or another, and if the dignity of a doctor's sympathetic touch was not enough, even for the dead, fire would suffice. A surprise of a different sort awaited us in the ruin of Europa's gondola. Master Topolsky and Dupin were there. Topolsky holding a service revolver of the sort carried by the regular airmen, and Dupin looking as if he might collapse at any moment, his skin sallow, his eyes staring into some incomprehensible infinity only he perceived. Beneath his cold weather garments, slung around him untidily, he still wore the sweat-sodden pyjamas I had ordered him to bed in. "This is a development," I commented.
"You were under arrest," Ramos said. "How are you at liberty, master?"
Murgatroyd was slowly unbuttoning the holster of his own revolver.
Now, Henry," Topolsky said, waggling the barrel of the weapon he held. "We won't be having that, not among civilized men."
"The captain wouldn't have let either of you off Demeter," I said. "So how did you escape?"
"Code, do you think me so negligent of my own interests as to only permit myself a single means of self-defense? Dear Coronel found my pretty little pistol indeed, but I had already taken pains to secrete a second firearm in my quarters, anticipating precisely this turn of events."
He regarded the revolver with amusement, as if it were an excellent hand in a card game, evidence of a rare combination of skill and luck.
"Of course, I waited a decent interval before freeing myself, allowing the captain time to relax his guard, which he duly did."
"And where is Van Voot?" I asked warily. "And the rest of the men who would have tried to stop you?"
"Beyond the modest reach of your talents, Code, that is for certain."
"You shot them, you bastard!" cried Mortlock.
"I did what was necessary for the pursuit of knowledge, you cretin."
"The pursuit of your own glory, more like."
I nodded at the boy. "Why did you drag Dupin into this madness? He was an innocent in all this."
"None of us are innocents. But you're quite wrong about me dragging him here. He came at his own insistence. Didn't you, Dupin?"
He waited a heartbeat.
"Answer him." "I had to come, Dr. Code. I knew you wanted me to rest, but I couldn't wait any longer. I saw it all."
"So what?" I asked tenderly.
"How to do it. How to understand the topology. It's all in those patterns, Doctor. Why, some bits of it are rough and some smooth. Don't you see?"
His eyes widened, straining at some feat of comprehension beyond the reach of ordinary men. Or, indeed, beyond anyone who had not already stared a little too eagerly into the abyss.
"He was all on the inside once, and all on the outside. It's a Moran surface, Doctor. A halfway point in classical sphere reversion. That's why it's so hard for us to see any order in the edifice. It's stuck halfway to being turned inside out. Something happened to it, Doctor, and I don't think it was meant to happen."
Dupin swooned. Topolsky tried to catch him, and that was all the distraction Murgatroyd needed. He sprang at his foe, reaching out to wrest the service revolver from Topolsky's grip. The gun went off. The discharge rang hollowly against the metal confines of the gondola. For some incomprehensible reason, I stared at my gut, convinced that I must have been shot there, even though the pistol had been pointed nowhere near my abdomen. I felt instantly foolish and narcissistic. There had been no pain, no punch of the bullet's momentum, and no blood puddled around my wound. I had not been shot. None of us had. The bullet had put a hole in the ceiling, puckering out through the thin skin, but it had done no harm to any of us. The revolver made a click, the firing pin landing on an empty chamber. It was spent. Murgatroyd wrenched it away from Topolsky and then landed a punch against our benefactor by way of additional satisfaction.
You bloody lunatic! You'll hang for this when we get back to England!
Dear old Blighty might have to wait,
Miss Cossiel said, dryly. The gondola lurched and slumped, in the manner of an elevator suddenly descending between floors. It came to rest, then slumped again. Slowly the angle of the floor was tilting.
He's punctured the envelope, I said, a dull realization coming over me. No individual gas cells up there. It only needs one puncture and the hydrogen starts leaking. They are going down,
Brooker exclaimed.
Into the void. Into the pit of eternal blackness beneath us.
Miss Cossiel leaned in and whispered,
Even by your standards, Silas, that was a little on the melodramatic side, don't you think?
Chapter 19. I fingered the mission patch, still counting the seven names as if something might change between one reading and the next. I remembered taking exam results in and out of an envelope, irrationally expecting the grades to improve if I just looked away. Later, when medicine had become my calling, my results had improved almost without effort. Because I loved it. Because it was what I was born to do. Medicine came more easily to me than anything else. But the sting of early failure still travelled with me. I'm not an official part of the mission, I said, musing aloud. But I knew what I was. The whole Demeter expedition was built on barely tested technologies. From the miniature fusion generators which powered the various spacecraft modules and support drones, through to the next generation suits, and finally the radical and risky hibernation processes. With so much to go wrong, the ship could not afford to travel without a dedicated medical specialist, even if that added to the overall expense and complexity. Dr. Silas Code, Demeter physician and flight surgeon. I'd already proved my worth. There had been a problem with that hibernation technology a few weeks into our cruise, when we were too far gone to turn around and way beyond any external medical assistance. Ramos had developed a bleed on the brain. The ex-Special Forces Mexican wasn't a tech trillionaire, scientist, or adventure seeker. His only role on the mission was security fulfillment, keeping the others out of unnecessary trouble, maintaining cordial relations between the expeditionary party and the civilian mission specialists, and making sure both parties adhered to the contracts and obligations agreed before departure. When we got to Europa, he was to identify and advise upon any unusual risk factors associated either with the subsurface operations or with the alien object we had come to investigate. Ramos did not have the authority to override either Van Voot or Topolsky, but without his cooperation and insight, the expedition was all but guaranteed to founder. I saved him. There was no pride in that statement, merely the recognition that I had already been of demonstrable value to the mission, erasing any doubts that might have lingered about the point of my being aboard. Ramos had needed emergency neurosurgery and weeks of rehabilitation. Even after I had saved his life, there had been no guarantee that he would still be functionally useful. But Ramos was a strong, determined man, and through great single-mindedness, he had gradually regained a complete range of functions, with no deficits in comprehension, speech, or fine motor control. To help him with his recuperation, I had even had the ship's 3D printer make a classical guitar. Ramos told me that he had played when he was young, mostly in lessons he was forced to take against his wishes, but he still remembered some of the simpler tunes and fingerings. Over those long weeks, I watched him mash his enormous fingers onto the frets, barely able to make a note to begin with, but slowly and doggedly overcoming himself. Once, in an uncharacteristic fit of temper, he smashed the guitar to shards and wanted no more of it. But a day later, he was begging me to put the pieces back into the printer and have the ship fab up a replacement. I smiled. I had already done so.
"Thank you, Silas," he said,
holding the semi-translucent instrument between his hands as if it were the kindest gift he had ever received.
"This one, I will take better care of it as you have taken care of me."
"Well, it's what I was put aboard to do," I told him. I moved through the ship now, finding 6 individual sleeping compartments for 6 of the named mission participants. Topolsky, Ramos, Brooker, Mortlock, Murgatroyd, and Dupin. Those were the 6 who had come down in the lander. The accommodation compartment for the 7th, Von Voot, was in the cruise module still in orbit. Although it meant there was a physical separation between the captain and the other 6 while the lander and cruise module were docked, that had been deemed preferable to a wasteful duplication of space and mass resources once the modules were separated. The 6 compartments, needless to say, were empty. They had been left tidy and well organized, with privacy screens drawn. No one had left in a hurry, but I had still been left behind. I inspected the personal goods, the handful of images and keepsakes that had been permitted. Even with our fusion propulsion, every extra kilo ferried to Jupiter and back, let alone down to Europa, came with penalties to the mission profile. The printed guitar was one of the bulkier personal items, but that at least had come out of our existing mass budget. I went to the racks near the ventral hydro lock, where we kept our Mark 13-5 multimode environment suits. These complex, cumbersome items were supposedly as good in vacuum as they were underwater, in the briny blackness of Europa's hidden ocean. Now they were all missing, their racks gleaming and empty. 6 suits, 6 empty racks. It had been so expensive and mass prohibitive to provide spare suits that we only brought 6 with us. They had gone outside. I went to the hydro lock and checked its cycle status. The locks kept a tally of whether they had been used for vehicle egress or entry the last time they were operated. I would need to check the others to be sure, but this lock was showing that it had last been used by crew members moving beyond Demeter into the ocean. "And then what?" I asked myself, my voice ringing through the empty passages and compartments.
"Good question."
I spun around, startled. Until that moment, my every impression had led me to believe that I had the ship to myself. But I had forgotten the other explorer, the other name that did not appear on the mission patch. Cossiel. She sat cross-legged on a grilled panel, dressed in the same kind of tight-fitting yellow resistance suit as I wore. A yellow mission cap pressed down on a mass of loose curls. My heart was racing.
"Where the hell were you?"
Her answer was calm, unfazed by my shock.
"Performing a systems inventory of the ship, just like you."
She glanced up and down the long main axis which threaded the tubular spacecraft.
"There's no one else aboard. I see from your interest in the suit racks and the hydro lock that you figured as much out for yourself."
Elements of our mission profile were returning to me a piece at a time. "Yes, which means they've gone out to explore the edifice, all 6 of them. Do we still have comms?" "No, wait." I rubbed the bridge of my nose, still gripped by a lingering fog, as if I had woken up with a thick hangover and only a vague sense of the events that had led up to it. "There was another ship. We didn't see it until we'd broken through the ice and entered the ocean."
"Yes, very good. The other ship was Europa. It was a similar expedition to our own, just not quite as large or well-equipped."
More came back to me. "We didn't even know about it."
"That's right.
Cossil shook her head in a sort of amazed horror.
Ramos went six kinds of apeshit when he realized Topolsky had been lying to the entire team, including him. Topolsky knew, of course. The lying fucker had always known. That earlier expedition was sent out under cover of secrecy, put together in a rush by one of his zillionaire playboy rivals. No oversight, no intergovernmental approval, no ethics scrutiny, no biocontamination protocols. Just old-school tech bro bullshit, as if rules are for the little people. The only thing that mattered was to beat the pan-national space agencies to the edifice, as if the world needed another lesson about the glorious fucking wonders of unfettered libertarian capitalism.
How did Topolsky know they'd got here first?
A combination of industrial espionage and the willingness of his other rivals to piss on one of their own. The enemy of my enemy, etc.
I shook my head, sharing her disapproval. People.
Indeed, Silas,
she answered, regarding me with a certain coolness.
Anyway, Topolsky got hold of a bunch of mission telemetry and tech upgrades from Europa through his corporate back channels, giving Demeter an idea of what to expect and more resilience to cope with it when we arrive. But he couldn't risk telling anyone Europa had failed and was still stuck down here with the loss of all crew. Who the hell would have signed on for that?
I see why Ramos wouldn't have been too pleased by any of that. But they all left anyway.
They had their bust up. Topolsky even pulled a taser on Ramos. He'd smuggled it all the way from Earth. Everything nearly fell apart right then. Except Brooker and Murgatroyd agreed to take a look inside Europa before deciding what to do next.
They found another empty ship, just like this.
Yes. Another six-person expedition. They'd run into trouble. Europa was in the process of being dismantled and assimilated into the edifice. The crew had gone in, cutting a hole in the side and installing a limpet hydrolock. We don't know what they were hoping to achieve at that point, whether it was pure exploration or desperation because the machine had already wrapped its fronds around their ship and they needed to negotiate with it or sabotage it. What we do know is this. One of them made it back to Europa, all the way back out through the hydrolock. And then they got pulled back in again.
My God!
There was just enough time to leave a message for whoever got here next. It says, "Get the fuck away from here now." So, guess what happened next?
They went in as well.
You've got a good handle on human nature, Silas. You've nailed one of the guiding principles. Always rely on people to do the exact opposite of what they should.
You could call it courage, I ventured. If the Demeter party thought there was a chance of there still being survivors inside that thing, well, weren't they under a moral obligation to investigate?
Even after that warning?
I'm just trying to be charitable. I liked them. I reflected on my answer. Some of them, anyway. Do we know what happened? Did they send back reports, telemetry, biometric feeds?
They're still in there,
she said.
And still alive. But they can't get out on their own. They're dying very slowly. The edifice is keeping them alive, but only for the purposes of information gathering. You've seen it for yourself, Silas. You know what's become of them.
La Vigilia de Piedra, I whispered, as a wave of recollection hit me. My God, I was there. We were there. But we aren't. We're here, you and I, inside Demeter. There's no way we ever went inside that thing because there were only ever six suits. Then a question that had been prickling against the back of my forehead finally found expression. I'm the flight surgeon.
For some reason, they didn't see fit to include my name on the mission roster, but... Where exactly do you fit in, Ada?
I was wondering when we'd get to first name terms, she said.
All right. Deep breath. She closed her eyes, made a yoga-like stretching pose.
Deep fucking breaths all around. You too, Bucko. You're going to need it.
Why? Cossiel opened her eyes.
Because this is the bit where you always lose it, Silas. Over and over again.
Try me, I insisted.
Oh, I will. Till it finally sticks and you stop reverting into yourself. Let's start with the most critical thing. Time. There isn't much of it left. Topolsky and the others have been inside the edifice for a lot longer than you think.
I hadn't given it any thought. They've been gone, what? I looked around as if there might be clues in the deposition of dust on the compartment surfaces. Some days already? It can't be longer than that. I don't know what happened to me, why I can't quite remember things properly, but I'm guessing I've been incapacitated.
Well, that certainly covers it.
But you wouldn't have allowed me to ignore my responsibilities for any length of time. Not while they're in there and we still have medical telemetry. They might be out of reach, but they're still under my care. I stared into her eyes, wondering what I was missing. How long has it been, Ada?
3 months, Silas. More than 100 days since they went into the object. That's how long I've been trying to get you to come round.
No, I said, almost laughing as I denied her. There's no way it's been 3 months.
It has. And now time's against us. It's not just the worsening condition of the six, it's the orbital module. We've been completely cut off while we've been down here. But that was always anticipated. Those 20 kilometers of ice above us act as a pretty good screen. But now we have to deal with the emergency mission contingency. Von Voot should have expected us back weeks ago.
Then he'll know something's wrong.
She'll know, Cossiel corrected. Captain Von Voot is Captain Jennifer Von Voot. You know that. You've always known it. It just didn't map very easily into those male-centric narrative scenarios you've been running. You gender-swapped her for the sake of old boy, historical verisimilitude. What matters now is this. Jenny von Voot is a stickler for mission protocol. When the clock runs out, she'll light the fusion motor for an Earth return burn, assuming the rest of the mission to be lost.
I forced aside the questions I wanted to ask her, as well as those I wanted to forget. How long?
200 hours, Silas, give or take. That's how long we've got to get in there, rescue the expeditionary party, and get them back within comms range of the orbiter.
I looked to the empty racks. We have no suits.
Nope.
What about the service drones?
Far too bulky to fit through that hydrolock. Same goes for the drones I've managed to commandeer from Europa. Even if they could fit through the lock, or cut their way in by other means, we know from the initial telemetry sent back by the expeditionary party that it's a tight squeeze in there. They can't help us.
Then I don't see what we can do.
There is one way. An asset belonging to Europa, already inside the edifice. We can control it, move it around, and use it to reach and assist the party.
After 3 months, do you really think there's going to be anything to save?
Right now there is. As I said, we have solid biometric traces. We can't wake them or raise them to the threshold of consciousness except as an absolute last resort. Their life support units are already at capacity, and higher brain function puts an even greater strain on their systems.
So they die if we wake them?
In a nutshell. The best that could be done would be rouse someone at short intervals, allowing them time to recover between lucid episodes. Even then, the damage would accumulate over time. We would only do that if we had no other option.
We won't be doing that.
She nodded. I'm glad you agree.
Then, after a sigh,
Ramos is the one exception to all this. That procedure you did on him? You put a neuroprosthetic lace into his skull before you closed him up. It was a medical safeguard against a recurrence of his brain bleed and a way of monitoring and shaping the regaining of function through his recuperation. But it's also given us an in.
An in, I repeated.
Thanks to the mediation of the lace, Ramos can spend time in a higher state of awareness than the others, with no serious side effects.
She looked at me shrewdly.
You must have been aware that there was something different about Ramos.
Different?
In your narratives. He wasn't just a bit player following your mental script. He had volition, will, a dawning realization that he was being swept along in someone else's fantasies, and he was starting to remember things between episodes, even to gain some dim understanding of his ultimate predicament.
All right, I said, nodding. This asset. We'll use it. We'll figure out how to get them out of that thing, and then we'll get back above the ice in time to signal Von Voot. That's all right. I can handle it, I really can. You said this was when I lost it. Well, I haven't lost it. I'm confused, doubtful, a little frightened, and I don't quite see where you fit into all this. But I haven't lost it.
Oh, you poor summer child.
Cossiel made a beckoning gesture, directing my attention to one of the screens still scrolling with numbers and symbols.
Tell me what you see.
I shrugged. Some kind of readout.
Go on.
I don't know. It looks like computer garbage to me. What do they call it? Core dump? Something like it?
You already know what it is, Ada said. It's code, Silas.